And now for our third and final part of our Jews of Kobe series. Joining me on the line is Cindy Klein, who is an international tour guide, whose website is Cindy Klein Tours. Cindy, I'm going to hand it over to you. For those who perhaps missed either our first or second part of the series, can you give us a quick update on what we've been chatting about regarding the Jews of Kobe and then bring us up to date with the story?
Okay, so I'm going to give a quick recap. We talked about the Jewish community of Kobe that really started when Japan opened up its ports to the world in the 1860s, when Jewish merchants started coming mainly from Iran, Iraq, and Russia. That was the first stage from the 1860s onwards. We then talked about the influx of Jews that came from through Lithuania, but from other parts of Eastern Europe, due to the help of many key figures, including a Japanese consul in Lithuania, Chihune Sugihara. We had gotten to the point where the Jews were already in Japan, and then it's in 1941, and they are being interrogated by the authorities. And after the interrogation, which was not a pleasant one, the Jews were sort of left alone, the Jews who only had 10-day transit visas to go through Japan, and they were meant to continue on elsewhere, mainly to the island of Curaçao. They were sort of left alone and allowed to stay in Japan longer. Some stayed a few weeks, some stayed a few months, some stayed many, many years. The story pretty much of the immigration ends there. And as I had said, most of those Jews ended up leaving and moving on elsewhere, most already during or immediately after the war. There were those who stayed. So what I wanted to move on to was, first of all, what happened to the Jewish community afterwards. Now, there continued to be a Jewish community, because when I had told you guys originally, there was a Jewish community before all of those immigrants came, which was, that was around 3,500 to 4,500 immigrants, or pass-throughers, whatever you want to call them. There were around 1,000 people or so in the Jewish community of Kobe and the eve of World War II. Now, this Jewish community continued to exist, continued to grow, and there was an Ashkenazi and Sephardi Jewish community. There were synagogues were in one main Jewish community center building, but unfortunately, during World War II itself, actually in 1945, towards the end of the war, that center was destroyed. And what happened was, there was a wealthy Syrian Jew named Rachmo Sassoon. There's also a David Sassoon, that's how I got the Rachmo Sassoon, who had been living in Kobe and doing business since 1936. And he offered to the Jewish community, he offered a warehouse building from his business to be used as a synagogue. And at the beginning, it was used as a synagogue. Eventually, in 1970, they tore down that warehouse and built a building that is standing till today, which is the Ohel Shlomo Synagogue, which is active, and it's a very interesting place. It's active, and the Jewish community of Kobe today is still using that synagogue. Rachmo Sassoon himself, he left Kobe before the synagogue was built. He left in 1964 because in the 60s and 70s, there started to be a bit of a recession in Japan, and a lot of the Jewish businessmen left. He actually left to live in New York. He was back and forth to Kobe. His wife actually retired in Kobe. I think she was living there well to the 2000s. He passed away in 2009 in New York. The building that he built is the synagogue of the Jewish community today. And I want to tell you a little bit about the Jewish community today. It's a very interesting community. While people emptied out of the community in the 60s, 70s, there still was always some people that, in COVID, but it was, the community was weak. And in the 90s and 2000s, there was an influx of Israelis, maybe mainly of Sephardi background. And in around 2010, a Chabad rabbi named Rav Shmulik Vyshedsky took over the synagogue. And today you have a fascinating community. It is a Sephardi shul praying in the Sephardi tradition, the Sephardi Nusach, run by a Chabad rabbi. And the synagogue, every Shabbat hosts groups and visitors from around the world.
Amazing. How big is the community today there?
So the Jewish community today is, it's a little bit complicated. Because whether you're counting the Jewish community or whether you're counting the Jews, because many of those in the community are married into the Jews and aren't necessarily Jewish themselves, hasn't necessarily gone through conversion. And some of the children also are not, haven't gone through conversion. But you have around 150 or so Jews in the community and around 300 people who consider themselves part of the Jewish community of Kobe today. And I wanted to add two more anecdotes if I have time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The building that was destroyed in 1945 by the bombing, the original Jewish community building, today there is a wall left over, and the city of Kobe has commemorated the Jewish community of Kobe at that wall. But it's not so simple that happened. And what I want to tell a story is, I take my groups there when we're there on Shabbat. We do a walking tour, and I take them to that wall, and I tell them the stories, many of those that I shared here on the radio. And we were there one time, and this Japanese man is sort of standing by my group and watching us. And then he asks me, he says, "Can I take some photos of you and your group?" And, you know, it's a little bit, you know, interesting and a little bit awkward. It's Shabbos, and I'm posing for pictures. I mean, we're not taking them, but okay.
Yeah.
And after he did it, he explained to me why. Or maybe it was even before. I don't remember the order of the events, but basically this Japanese man must have been in his 40s or something, not an old man. He was on the committee that decided that fought actually to keep that wall up and to make it into a monument to the Jewish community of the pre-World War II. And he basically wanted these photos to prove that their efforts were worthwhile, and that it's bringing tourists to Kobe, and it's bringing Jewish tourists, and the visitors are coming and visiting this wall. And he wanted to bring it back to the city council, whoever, to show them, because he told us it's a constant battle. And it's actually funny, as I call it the Kotel, because it's like the wall that went around everything. Today it's like a high tech building or something behind it. I don't remember what, but the building behind is rebuilt, but the wall that went around the Jewish community center, which housed the synagogues and all the organizations, is the only thing standing. The original wall that was built in the 30s, this specific building. But it's that's fascinating. And one last thing I wanted to share, if we have time, was the aftermath of Sugihara, which I don't think I shared.
No, you didn't. Please share it.
So Sugihara, it was actually, he led a very sad life. Sugihara, remind you, was the consul who against the orders of the Japanese government, he issued he saved thousands of lives through the visas that he issued during World War II.
And he was Lithuania.
He was in Lithuania. He was then sent home to Japan, stripped of his position.
Because he'd done
shamed,
this.
Because he did this. He was then shamed. He had to live like anonymously and move from place to place and take up odd jobs, because in Japanese society, when you're shamed, that's it. He didn't live he led a life of poverty and shame afterwards, and he didn't know till much later on about the lives that he saved. Uh-huh. And in fact, he wasn't honored by Yad Vashem as for being a righteous Gentile until 1985. And why, and he passed away in 1986. Why, what took so long for Yad Vashem to honor him wasn't that they didn't appreciate him, wasn't that they didn't know about the many lives that he saved, was that one of the conditions for being a righteous Gentile was that you had to have risked your life. And he didn't risk his physical life. He may have risked
his quality of life, his reputation, but
they decided in 1985 to change the criteria, and they recognized him. At that point, he was too elderly and sick to make it to Jerusalem, but his wife and his son came and received that honor for him.
But he was aware of it,
and,
right?
And no, he was aware, but he just wasn't able. He wasn't able, and he passed away approximately a year later.
And Cindy, the Japanese government, did they honor him and recognize what he did during his lifetime?
Yeah. So this, not during his lifetime, but this is sort of, I'm going to be a little bit critical here. They, after shaming him during his lifetime, they posthumously jumped on the bandwagon a little bit after Yad Vashem honored Sugihara. And today there is a Japanese museum honoring Sugihara, and they've rewritten the history in this museum, and they call him a Japanese hero.
But he wasn't alive to see
that. He was not honored as a Japanese hero, unfortunately.
Oh no, that's heartbreaking. That's really sad.
So, but you know what, at least today, I mean, for his lifetime, his family in the end got that honor. I understand that his grandson continues to speak and continue the legacy of talk about the legacy of his grandfather, and so at least the honor of the family was restored by the Japanese government. You know, at least that. But yeah. So that's, I think that's how I'm going to end the story today.
Fascinating, fascinating. The Jews of Kobe, who would have thought? And for anyone listening, if you're interested, there are still spaces in Cindy's tours to Japan in December this year and in March, May and June next year. And if you're interested, you can be in touch via cindyklinetours@gmail.com. So that's C-I-N-D-Y. Klein is K-L-I-N-E. So it's one word, cindyklinetours@gmail.com. Or you can visit her website at cindyklinetours. And Cindy, thank you so much for chatting with us. It's been a fascinating three-part series on the Jews of Kobe, Japan.